Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches.
Our last speaker is one of our most distinguished military historians. Andy Beaver's bestsellers include Stalingrad, Berlin, The Downfall, D-Day, The Battle for Normandy, Arnhem, The Battle of the Bridges, and his new book is Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs. Ladies and gentlemen, Anthony Beaver.
Thank you very much indeed. Grigory Rasputin's name is beyond notorious. He has entered popular legend and even popular song, dare I say it, not sing it, as Rara Rasputin, lover of the Russian queen and Russia's greatest love machine. As a result, the myths surrounding him have swollen totally out of proportion. Yet in a bizarre reversal of the great man theory of history, Rasputin, although a barely literate peasant from Siberia, is one of the most enigmatic and influential figures of modern history. He had no official position and no mass following, yet unintentionally he became the major contributor to the collapse of the greatest autocracy in the world. As Alexander Kerensky, the leader of the provisional government after the revolution of February 1917, observed, without Rasputin there would have been no Lenin. The Empress Alexandra became infatuated with Rasputin, who seemed to be the only person who could cure her haemophiliac son. This and a stolen letter in which she had written that she longed to fall asleep forever on his shoulder convinced many that she was sleeping with Rasputin. It was totally untrue. Yet the Tsar himself appeared a weak and complacent cuckold. In Russia's deeply patriarchal society, such impressions, however false, shattered the myth of Romanov power consolidated by Nicholas's father, Alexander III. Outrageously untrue rumours that Rasputin was even sleeping with their teenage daughters fed a growing taste for mindless scandal, similar to the pornographic fantasies just before the French Revolution, with the false accusations of a lesbian affair between Marie Antoinette and the Princesse de Lamballe. As a result, by the time of the popular uprising of February 1917, the Tsar had lost so much respect that not a single officer in the Imperial Life Guard Regiment in Petrograd were prepared to raise a sword in his defence. When a ruling regime loses confidence in such a way, revolution is easy. Rasputin's vertiginous rise to influence in those years before the First World War had seemed so improbable that the story gripped not just Greater Russia, but foreign countries too. How could a simple peasant, a self-proclaimed man of God, achieve such power from soon after his arrival in Petersburg? It is indeed hard to believe, but one should not forget the saying of the great 19th century poet Fyodor Tyutchev, that Russia cannot be understood with the mind alone. Neither can Rasputin. He combined spiritual innocence and rampant lust, intense religious faith and cynical opportunism, boasting and paranoia, self-knowledge and fantasy, instinctive generosity and cupidity. All the intriguing paradoxes of his character, as well as the astonishing story of his life and grisly death, defy conventional logic. Rasputin claimed to have received the call of God in his late 20s. Soon afterwards, in 1897, he announced his intention to take to the road as a wandering pilgrim or stranik. He left his wife, Paskovya, and their children in their Siberian village of Pokrovskoy to visit holy places, including Mount Athos. In the latter part of 1904, Rasputin moved to the ancient Tatar city of Kazan on the Volga, invited by a wealthy widow whom he'd met and impressed on one of his journeys. She proceeded to present him to the local worthies and grandees, and a belief in his ability to heal spread rapidly. He prayed with the afflicted and managed to console the grieving. He also won over local churchmen, Yet rumours soon spread of his visits to bathhouses with young women whom he persuaded to wash him in the most intimate way. Rasputin's dramatic advancement came soon afterwards. A senior churchman in Kazan was impressed by him and recommended him to an even more influential bishop in St. Petersburg. November 1905, Rasputin was introduced to Tsar Nicholas and the Empress. The timing could not have been more fortunate for him. Nicholas was dejected after the disaster of the war with Japan and the resulting disorders all over Russia, bringing the country very close to revolution. He felt humiliated because he'd been forced to agree to the calling of a parliament, the Duma, and a first step towards a constitution which undermined the illusion of Romanov autocracy. Not surprisingly, word of the imperial family's interest in the Siberian peasants soon spread, and social success followed rapidly in some of the great houses of the capital, where a certain fin de siècle fascination with spiritualism flourished. Many women were entranced by Rasputin, almost falling at his feet. While most of the men tended to react against him, this was largely because he was conspicuously refused to conform to the behaviour of polite society. Whether princess or housemaid, he addressed everybody with the familiar tea. He embraced and kissed on first introduction, charming some and appalling others with his peasant manners and impudently direct questions. The composure of his female devotees, soon dubbed Rasputinière, was undoubtedly disturbed. There were grand ladies who volunteered to cut his fingernails so that they could take the clippings as sacred salad talismans to sew into their dresses. Even fish bones and pieces of half-chewed food from his plate were seized as semi-holy objects. Churchmen who were wondered by Rasputin's intense spirituality then could still turn against him later when they recognized his lascivious side. The Hierom monk Iliador was at first enchanted, believing him to be great prophet, clairvoyant, miracle worker, and ascetic. But then he became his most bitter enemy, considering him to be a devil clothed in the garments of an angel. In St. Petersburg, Rasputin, despite the dislike of most men, soon became the talk of the capital. Grand hostesses competed in giving dinners to introduce him to their friends. They'd also invite him to draw in other famous names, and Rasputin himself might ask the hostesses to invite somebody he wanted to meet, and he rapidly became an inveterate name-dropper. Other members of the Romanov dynasty could not believe how the Tsar and Tsaritsa accepted Rasputin almost as a member of the family. In January 1910, he spent a number of evenings at the Alexander Palace. According to the Tsar's diary, he was there at least 5 times in 2 weeks, and it's astonishing how the Tsar could record in his diary that he'd returned to find his wife alone with Rasputin and how happy he had been to join their conversation. The fact that this was a serious breach of protocol, let alone a meeting which could fatally compromise the Empress's reputation, did not appear to strike him. Every scandal Rasputin caused was dismissed by the Empress. It convinced her that he was a saint unjustly reviled and persecuted out of evil jealousy. Whenever the Holy Synod or the bishops criticized him, she simply said, "The official church has always crucified its prophets." Rasputin's wife, Praskovya, a simple but intelligent woman, as Lily Den wrote, was unconcerned by her husband's activities in St. Petersburg. She simply felt sorry for him in the belief that he truly suffered from his lust, a similar idea to that supposedly Sophoclean notion that the male of the species was chained to the lunatic of his libido. But Praskovya never heard of the fate of more vulnerable, even desperate women from the lower orders who sought Rasputin's help to gain exemption for a husband or a son from frontline service in the army. Stepan Beletsky, the Tsar's minister for police, soon became aware of what he called Rasputin's peculiar handling of lady supplicants, especially the poorer, more vulnerable ones. This was a euphemism for blackmail up to and including outright rape. St. Petersburg, or Petrograd as it became in wartime, was soon riddled with corruption, much of it carried out by Rasputin's entourage. While many devoted themselves to selfless war work and others profited from the opportunities through massive and often chaotic government spending, morphine from military hospitals was soon openly on sale in nightclubs. So was a seemingly unlimited supply of cocaine, which somehow reached Russia despite wartime conditions and blockades. Underage prostitutes haunted the smart hotels. Some seemed to revel in the debauchery all around them. The novelist Alexei Tolstoy, later known as the Red Count, wrote that the macabre rhythm of the tango had become a death march for a city tormented by sleepless nights, stupefied and deadened by wine, wealth, and lovemaking without love. Yet, the greatest damage to confidence during the Tsar's absence at the general headquarters, the Stavka, had come from the Empress and Rasputin persuading him to dismiss and appoint ministers on their recommendation. Their criteria was to choose only someone who was their devoted supporter. When the Grand Duchess Fyodorovna, wife of the Grand Duke Cyril, was received by the Empress, she made the mistake of thinking that the obvious threat of revolution would make Alexandra more open to discussion. She mentioned the hostility which she faced. The Empress cut her short. "I know that it is just Petrograd society which hates me, that corrupt and impious society which thinks only of dancing and dining and shows no interest in anything but its pleasures and adulteries, while on every side blood is flowing." She went on to claim angrily that the whole of Russia, the true Russia, the Russia of simple folk and peasants, is with me. Her obduracy would soon end not just with the dramatic murder of Rasputin, but with the massacre of herself, her entire family, and her husband's relations. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial" as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial".